Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 to 14. There is a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to mend, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What do workers gain from their toil? I've seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the heart, in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him.
Has anyone seen Samuel Beckett's play called Breath or heard about it? I don't think it's particularly popular. You'll understand why in a minute. It was on in the West End some years ago. Let me tell you how it goes. The curtain opens to reveal a dimly lit stage with nothing on it except for a bit of rubbish strewn in the middle. As the light grows a little bit less dim, you hear a faint human cry. Then you hear a breath, inhaling and exhaling. Then you hear another cry, and then the curtain falls. That's it. The directions to the play occupy one single page and take longer to read than the events they describe. It's all over in 35 seconds. I wonder how you would have responded had you gone to see Beckett's play. You'd probably be wondering what to do with the rest of your evening. But apart from that, what do you make of what he's trying to say? Is that all our lives are? Just a cry at birth, a cry at death, and in between, just a breath? Well, I don't know if Beckett had read Ecclesiastes, but he's not far from what we saw last week as the central message of the book. If you remember, the book contains the words of the teacher, a man of great wisdom, who's giving his observations on life under the sun. That is, life in this fallen world. And his conclusion is hard to miss. He repeats it 37 times throughout the book, and he gives it right at the start. 1 verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. That word is literally the word breath or vapor. And it's a word that has a number of shades of meaning. The teacher is saying that life in this world is like a breath. Last week the focus was on the fact that life is transitory and insubstantial. It doesn't last and it doesn't satisfy. This week, the focus is on the fact that life is incomprehensible. It's beyond our grasp. You know, like breath, you can't get hold of it. You can't tie it down. You can't control it. And sometimes it just doesn't make sense. So this morning, we're going to trace through a number of themes that come in chapters 3 to 10. I'm going to refer to a number of passages. You don't have to turn to them all. But all these themes are kind of making the same point, that life is incomprehensible. It doesn't make sense. Firstly, we see that there is no discernible order to our lives. No discernible order to our lives. That poem at the beginning of chapter 3 is often read at funerals. And at first sight, first reading, it comes across as a kind of comforting poem describing an ordered and balanced world in which everything has its time and place. Now, that idea may well be present here, but I think there's more going on. Given the context of Ecclesiastes, this poem, I think, is at least partly about the tyranny of time. The fact that the events of our lives happen to us and are ultimately not in our control. We have very little to say over what happens in our lives. We don't know whether the next family announcement is going to be someone's birth or someone's death. We don't know if tomorrow we're going to be laughing or crying. And if you look down the list in verses 1 to 8, each line has a pair of things, doesn't it? Kind of opposites. Time to be born, a time to die, time to plant, time to uproot. And it seems like in each pair there's a good event and a bad event, but sometimes the good one comes first, sometimes the bad one comes first. And there doesn't seem to be any real pattern. It's like flipping coins. You don't know whether you're going to get heads or tails. You might get six tails in a row. The moments of our lives come before us like a conveyor belt. If we were robots, it wouldn't bother us. We'd just accept whatever comes next and deal with it. But we're not robots, and so we find ourselves asking why. We instinctively try to discern an order to the events of our lives. We have a sense that there must be a purpose to it all, but we can't quite figure it out. And that's, I think, what verse 11 is getting at. Just pick up again from 3 verse 10. I've seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. God has laid a burden on people, and the burden, at least partly, is he's set eternity in our hearts. So we have a longing for something beyond this life, beyond this world. We have a sense there is a bigger picture, an order and purpose, but we can't see it. As it says, no one can fathom what God has done. It's as if we're a small insect kind of crawling over this huge masterpiece, and we get glimpses of the picture, but we don't have the ability to stand back and see the whole thing. And the frustrating thing is we have a sense there is a bigger picture. We just can't see it. So firstly, there's no discernible order. Secondly, there's no dependable justice. Not only are the events of our lives beyond our control, but sometimes they are, quite frankly, unfair. Look at 3:16. I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. The teacher looks out on the world and he sees injustice. Evil seems to have the upper hand. Even in the places where there should be justice, wickedness is there. Bad people get away with murder and good people suffer. And again, there's this incomprehensible nature to it. It doesn't make sense. The teacher wants us to realize that part of the nature of life in this world is that injustice and evil occur everywhere. And sometimes it's unbearable. Just look at the beginning of chapter 4. Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is the one who's never been born, who's not seen the evil that is done under the sun. It's pretty strong stuff, isn't it? He's saying that sometimes oppression and injustice get so bad you feel like you'd be better off dead. Now, I guess few of us have reached that point, but far too many in our world have. Simon Porter, our friend who works with OMF in Cambodia, who Jason went and worked with earlier in the year, when he first went out to Cambodia, sent me this book called The Tears of My Soul. It's written by a guy who lived through the killing fields, survived. He tells a bit of his story. I'll just read you a short excerpt. A week later, my younger brother was arrested by the Klop in the village. The Klop is like a member of the Khmer Rouge, a soldier in that communist party and group. I looked out of the window to see my brother being led past with his arms tied behind his back. I hastily called to my parents. As we came out, the Klop hung him on the fence outside the house and ordered us to stand in line and watch his punishment. I couldn't believe my eyes. How could they punish him any further? He was already so badly beaten up that his face was scarcely recognizable. We watched helplessly as my brother received the worst beating of his life. He was only 10 years old. We were powerless to help, unable to protest. To object to what they were doing would be rebellion, punishable by death. We could only stand and look at them enjoying their game of torture. We had no idea what my brother was supposed to have done, but we couldn't speak to him. When he began to lose consciousness, a clock noticed and poured water on him to revive him. As I stood watching, I wished God would take my life right then so I wouldn't have to watch such things ever again. And he says at the end, after describing the ordeal, I wanted justice for my younger brother, but I knew it was a hopeless cause. There would be no justice. Now, he's writing about a particularly horrific time and experience. Thankfully, very few of us will ever have to experience anything like that. And yet, I guess some of us have at least reached that point where we've cried out in anguish, why is this happening to me? Mr. Teacher does affirm that justice will be done. He says in 3:17, I thought in my heart, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked. There will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed. And yet he goes on in the following verses to say he's not sure whether there's really anything beyond this life, beyond death. It seems to be another feature of life in this world. He's sure there must be a time when justice will be done, but he can't quite see how or when. So there's no dependable justice in the world. Thirdly, there's no avoidance of death. In chapter 9, Mr. Teacher deals with the subject of death head on. He says in verse 2, all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean, the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who don't. As it is with the good, so with the sinful. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. Death is no respecter of persons. It happens to us all, regardless of our rank or moral standing in the world. And not only that, but as he says in 9 verse 12, no one knows when that hour will come. You just don't know what tomorrow will bring. It could be the day you die. Now, for many people, such a reality is too depressing, so they just ignore it. But the author says that would be a foolish thing to do. In chapter 7, he says, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, because death is the destiny of everyone, and the living should take this to heart. In other words, it's good for us to face the reality of death, to be aware of our own mortality. And part of that awareness is a recognition that we have absolutely no control over it. There's no avoidance of death. Fourthly, there's no answer through wisdom. He says in chapter 8, no one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. This is verse 14, I think. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they can't really comprehend it. It can't be done, he says. There is this incomprehensible nature to life. God's in control and we just can't work out exactly what he's doing. We strive to accumulate wisdom, hoping to find answers, hoping to gain clarity and a greater control over our lives, but Mr. Teacher says we'll never achieve it. Let me quote to you from the classic movie Notting Hill, source of all philosophical truth. There's a scene where Bella, who is consigned to a wheelchair, says this. And she's speaking at a time that all the friends are gathered at their friend Tony's fish restaurant, which has flopped and he's going to have to sell it. She says, I have a little speech to make. I won't stand up because I can't be bothered. Exactly a year ago today, this man here started the finest restaurant in London. Unfortunately, no one ever came to eat here. And so we must face the fact that from next week, we have to find somewhere else to eat. I just wanted to say to Tony, don't take it personally. The more I think about things, the more I see no rhyme or reason in life. No one knows why some things work out and some things don't, why some of us get lucky and some of us get fired. And what Bella says is right, isn't it? At the end of the day, no one knows why things work out the way that they do, why some people find a perfect partner, without even trying, and other people have to live without the relationship that they long for. Why some people have to spend their lives battling serious illness while others have never had to take a day off sick. While some people miss a plane that would take them to their death, and other people take a holiday and end up dying in a natural disaster. No one knows why some people face unemployment and childlessness and grief, while others seem to get an easy ride on life's fast lane. And when we come across these perplexing situations in our lives, Ecclesiastes says we mustn't expect to get easy answers. We shouldn't be surprised when we feel perplexed. That is the nature of life in this world. When we ask why, we rarely get the neat, tidy, satisfying answers that we long for. And neither should we try and give easy answers to others. Yes, there's truth we can share, but let's be careful about trying to wrap it all up in a neat and tidy packaged, cliched answer. When we encounter people rubbing up against the frustrations of life, we won't often be able to give them the neat, tidy answers. And often it's our silence and our presence that is going to bring them most comfort. So there's no answer through wisdom. This is the nature of life in a fallen world, says Ecclesiastes. There's no discernible order to our lives. There's no dependable justice. There's no avoidance of death. There's no ultimate answer. Now, many people look at this. They look at all the perplexities and confusion of life, and they say, well, there you go. There must not be a God. Or if there is, he's on holiday, or at least he's not doing a very good job of running his world. But the reality is that the perplexities of life are actually evidence that there is a God and he is involved. As I said last week, Ecclesiastes is really expounding Genesis chapter 3. It's the writer's observations on life in a fallen world, a life under God's judgment, a world that has experienced and is experiencing God's curse. There's something wrong with the world, and the Bible says, yes. We've rejected our Creator, and we live in a world in which we experience his judgment. Now, in the light of all this, how do we respond? Let's look at three quick applications. Two from Ecclesiastes, one from the New Testament. Firstly, we should fear God. We should fear God. 3 verse 14, the writer says, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. If you think about it, there's a kindness in God's judgments. He kind of makes life the way it is so that we recognize we are not gods, that our lives are a breath, that we're mortal, finite human beings, that we can't control our lives and we can't prevent our deaths. That we can't guarantee anything. And it should lead us to humility, to give up on our grand efforts at greatness and to fall on our knees before the one who is God. We can't resist him. We must submit to him. He's the one who has the answers and he's the one who's in control. Firstly, fear God. But secondly, enjoy life. This is the repeated application through this, at times, depressing book, which is surprising. But we need to realize that the teacher, for all the frustrations and kind of darkness that he sees in the world, he is not saying that life is void of goodness. There are still good things to be enjoyed. Just turn to 8, verse 15. He gives us his response to the perplexing injustice of life. He says, verse 15, so I commend the enjoyment of life. Not despair, but joy. Because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of the life God has given them under the sun. So if we're finding life confusing, if we're having a tough time, in one sense we shouldn't be surprised. That's the nature of life in this world. But there are still good things to be enjoyed. So much of our discontentment in life comes because we think we have rights, you know, rights to a happy, healthy, wealthy, trouble-free life. We have a right to understand why things go the way they do. We want to be in control. But Ecclesiastes forces us to recognize we're not. We're not the masters of our lives. The days of our lives in this world are given to us as a gift. We don't know how many days we'll get. We don't know what those days will hold. We're not in control. God is. And so we need to let go of our supposed rights and simply be grateful for the good things that God gives us. He hasn't promised us freedom from adversity, and he hasn't promised us answers when adversity comes. But he does give us good things, and we should enjoy them as the gifts they are. So if there's food on the table at lunchtime, which I trust there will be, although I have no idea who's meant to be catering. Jade is catering. If there is, then rejoice in that simple blessing. If you wake up tomorrow morning and there's air in your lungs, then give thanks for another day of life graciously given to you. If you have useful work to do, then be glad. We should fear God. We should enjoy life. Thirdly and finally, we should look to Jesus for fulfillment. Some people say we can enjoy all God's blessings now. We can have all the answers now. But it seems to me that would be to deny what Ecclesiastes teaches, let alone the life and teaching of Jesus. Life in this world will always involve frustrations. We mustn't look for ultimate fulfillment here and now. But the New Testament brings into focus the hope of a world to come. A life not under the sun, but beyond the sun. A life in which there will be answers. A life in which there will be justice. A life in which there will be no more oppression and no more death. And that life is made possible only through the salvation that Jesus has accomplished. In a few minutes, we're going to share in the Lord's Supper and remember what Jesus has done to secure that salvation for us. But it's worth just taking a minute to think about how he saved us, how he's brought about this hope. See, it wasn't by bypassing this fallen world. No, he entered it. He took on a mortal human body. He experienced all of the frustration of life in this fallen world. In the place of justice, he suffered wickedness. And he suffered an unbelievably painful death. Even the immortal Son of God did not avoid death. And as he hung on the cross, he too cried out, "Why?" On the face of it, Jesus' death looks like a complete waste. Doesn't it? Another example of the perplexing nature of life in this world. To preach Jesus' death as good news seems utter foolishness. And yet the gospel tells us Jesus' death is the very power and wisdom of God. For by suffering as a victim of an unjust world, Jesus has saved us from the injustice of this life. But by enduring death himself, he's drawn its sting so that we can face it without fear. And through his resurrection, Jesus has brought life and immortality to light. Jesus' anguished why has been answered. You know, the magnificent purpose of his death has been revealed. And that gives us hope that there's a reason for the suffering that we experience. And that the perplexing events of our lives will one day be made known. That the purpose of those things will one day be made known. So as we live in this fallen world, as we go through life under the sun, let's make sure we keep our eyes fixed on the one who's gone before us, the one who has shared our road and who knows our pain, and has blazed a trail through suffering and through death to glory. Fear God. Enjoy life. Look to Jesus for fulfillment.